Thank you. It's nice to see you here again. Those of you who have been to these talks know that there are a couple of ideas that I keep coming back to when it comes to Shakespeare. One of them is that sometimes people get in their own way when they fall in love, love never takes a straight line in Shakespeare. It is always a path that is crooked. And the fact that you have to go this way and that way to get to the destination is very interesting. It says something about the limitations of people and the difference between the first impression of someone and what a person has to do to actually make contact with that other person, whether it's a parent or a lover or a child. There always seems in Shakespeare to be a challenge, which is to see the person standing in front of you, or in the case of King Lear, see who you actually are. And those are the most dramatic moments in the plays. As You Like It is a case study in people getting in their own way when falling in love. And like so many comedies, it begins with obstacles. I'll give you a little plot, but we won't talk a lot about plot. We have two friends, one of whom has a father who is ruling in a kingdom. The other friend's father is in exile. It's clear that the one whose father is in exile, Rosalind, will not be able to marry and cannot find a romantic partner, although she happens to meet one in the first act of the play. So there's an obstacle. And Shakespeare built his comedies so that in the early phases of the play and the story, you get to see the obstacle very clearly. That's really what you have to get done in the opening act of a comedy. The second thing he does is allow his characters some room to breathe, to become someone else, or to go somewhere else that is different. And that journey is often into the forest. It involves a transformation, and it enables the lover and the beloved to return back to the original location, which is usually the city or the state, and get married. That is the formula for comedy in the Renaissance. If there was a definition, what is a comedy? I should ask you, what is a comedy?
Something that is supposed to be funny.
Yes, and that is the definition that we use today. I used to talk about video stores when they existed, but now people stream things on Netflix. But you can get a section that's called comedy, and you kind of know what you're getting. It'll be funny. In the Renaissance, there was a more deliberate definition. A comedy is a story that mixes characters from different social classes, and it's a story that ends in marriage. If you don't get to a wedding, it didn't work. Other storytelling genres like tragedy have some different formula. A tragedy, which people have been thinking about since Aristotle, is a story of someone who goes from high to low. This person is usually important, or a king. And in going from high to low, this person has to have a discovery, some kind of discovery about themselves. So self-discovery is built into tragedy, but it also happens in comedy. And a particularly good critic of Shakespeare named Northrop Frye wrote a book about the green world of comedy. And he had a theory, which was that for people to fall in love with the person they really love and to become the person who can love that other person, they need to go away. They need to go into the forest. They need to be transformed. And the Forest of Arden was one of the ideas that Shakespeare had about where he could send his wandering, kind of self-defeating comic heroes. because once you're in the forest, you're away from the usual strictures of court life. And as you'll see tonight, one of the most important things about what happens in the forest is that people talk about not being at court. Let's go hunt some venison, you know, as you know, gamely. Let's go into the forest and find our own food. There's conversations in the play, which you'll see, about the fact that, oh, I just ran into a clown, a fool, someone who knows how to do it right. What are they doing in the forest? Where did he learn that stuff? There is an amazing section in this play where Touchstone talks about the degrees of dueling. And if you've seen Hamilton, you know that there's a lot of discussion about how you get into or out of a duel. Well, in the Renaissance, that was a very structured process. First person says, I don't like the cut of your beard. Person who gets the insult might say, well, I think it's just fine. They can escalate. But as soon as the accuser says, this is the thing, if you say this phrase, the person you've addressed it to is duty-bound to challenge you to a duel. And there are degrees of insult that get you up there, and then there are ways of getting out of it. And there's a, just listen tonight when you hear how Touchstone solves this problem of having ratcheted up a conflict. Anyways, Touchstone gives the kind of textbook example of how you argue degrees of insult, which ends in the highest form, which is when you say, thou liest. And you can add, in the back of thy throat, which I guess means you're digging deep for that lie. That's the moment when someone's honor has been unambiguously attacked. And that's the moment where you have to counterattack. But there were manuals about how to get into and out of an argument, which will lead to a duel, perhaps. Shakespeare knew about these manuals. He makes references to them in the play. And this fool who's making his way around the forest is ready to recite them as if by catechism. We start here, we go here, we go here, we go here. What is a person like that doing in the forest? Well, he's wandering, he's away. This is a place where people are going to take what they knew, try it out, and find out something else. And that's what's great about the forest. It's a respite. It's a time away. The larger picture of comedy that comes from that is that, here's the meta thought, comedy itself, that is, going to a play, you're about to do it tonight, at a moment in our history that's very, very complicated here in Washington, you're about to go to a play, and that is your Forest of Arden. Plays are places where our imagination is allowed to, the horses get to go out of the barn and run fast. That's a bit, I think that's what happens in theater. And the play is there to invite you in. There's a ritual to it. You're going to go. You'll have a seat. You'll sit in your seat. You may look at your program. At some point, the lights will come down, or someone will signal that it begins, and there you are in the forest. And just as the heroes in this story need to flee, and they may bring their cell phones with them to Arden, I think actually what they had was messengers, but we'll see a little more of that in the play. So the thing that is going to happen is you're going to go there with these characters. And what Shakespeare is counting on is the idea that as they transform, as they get a little bit of play in their world, where they can wiggle free, you can too. A comedy is a story that shows you the world as we might wish it to be. Sometimes it just tells us right up front, I know this is impossible. I know this is very unlikely. But I also know that you really, really want Rosalind and Orlando to get together. And I'm going to honor that wish because in the end, what comedy says is possibly the most real thing in the universe is our desires. more real than objects, more real than planets. The reality of the wish that you bring with you into the theater is something that gets to be completely real. And then it's honored. That's magic. If it works, you leave with a sense that the trip to the forest, the trip into the theater, has let you to become someone else, not because you are physically changed, but because you leave with a confidence in the power of the imagination, the power of restoration and self-recreation. You should also leave with an appreciation for the power of play. That thing that mammals do from the very beginning. So let's just talk a little bit about play and romance. One of the features of this story is that Celia and Rosalind are going to go to the forest and they are going to go in disguise. There's a word that we use today, which you'll know, travesty. You've heard that word. Oh, that speech was a travesty. Oh, that part, that deal was a travesty. The original meaning of that word comes from the Latin, which means across and to dress, transvestire. It means to disguise oneself. And the early meaning of that word applies to what's happening in the forest because female characters are wearing male clothing. It's a travesty. Well, what is it a travesty of? It's a travesty of their gender and sex. And it's deliberate. So why do they have to do that? Well, they're women traveling alone in the forest. That's one reason. But there's another reason, which is that as soon as you get in disguise, you can do things that you couldn't do before. There is a freedom in travesty. You can think things, say things, and maybe even want things that you couldn't do if you were in your right clothing, in your right costume, and being the person you've always been. That is the first part of this transformation, is deliberately becoming someone else. Why is that helpful? Well, I think it's because in the case of lovers, people really do need to get out of their own way. And sometimes the emotional dynamics of these characters are such that they are in love with something that they actually don't want. And they need to fall in love with someone that they really do want. That's becoming a mature person in love. And Shakespeare is really interested in that story. He's interested in how hard it is to do that. It's so hard, in fact, that you've got to pull everyone from the city. You've got to take them to the forest. You've got to put some shepherds in there. You need to put a clown, maybe a few deer. You need all of that to bring about the transformation. Back up one step and remember that the female characters in this play, Rosalind and Celia, in the early 1600s, are in the professional English theater, which means they are young boys. Probably younger than 14. They are transvestites. They're dressing contrary to their born or acknowledged gender. And they're performing that travesty on stage. So that's where it starts. Rosalind and Celia are boys. Not only that, the audience knows it. Audience knows it. There are many jokes in Renaissance plays that, from Ben Jonson's plays and Shakespeare's plays, that show that the playwright knew, that the audience knew, that the woman on stage was a boy. And so, I don't know what the best way to describe it is, there's a lot of winking going on. And that must have been part of the fun. Because they were really good. Children are terrific mimics. And you would marvel at the fact that they were so good. when a boy played Rosalind, when a boy played Ophelia, when a boy played Cordelia. But then, if you get a plot like the one in As You Like It, you get to put them back in boy's dress. Double travesty. Hard for us to appreciate in a performance where an adult female character is playing the romantic female lead. But I want to call your attention to that because I thought I would read just a brief scene from one of the Forest courtships. One of the things that Rosalind has to do in this play is teach Orlando how to be in love with her. She's like a tutor. And she's got a student who's really dense. Really dense. He writes love poems. The love poems are terrible. He pins the love poems on the trees. You'll see how they do that in our theater. He also does all this kind of by the book. He's heard people talk about how to be in love. So she says, all right, well, I'm going to teach you something else, but I see what you're doing. I see these love poems to me all around the forest. I really like this guy, but I've got to do something with him because he just doesn't get it. So there's a boy actor is playing Rosalind, being courted by a naive male actor, Orlando, disguised as a male. We've got to keep this straight. And then Ganymede, which is the male name of Rosalind, is going to pretend like she is a woman in order to tutor Orlando on how to fall in love. So there are at least three layers of travesty. That's Shakespeare's wink. You know that I know, and there's some clues too, but you know that I know that this young boy is playing a girl who dresses as a boy to go back at the forest, wink, who then plays the role of a woman so that she can teach her lover how to be a man. He's showing off. People can say things when they're playing that they can't say to each other. That's why play is really important. They can acknowledge certain things that they can't acknowledge when the stakes are high and they're face to face. The moment when you propose, the moment when someone says yes. How do you relax that for people who are not yet ready to be in love? Well, you get this triple travesty going. You get some love classes in the forest, and you do it in the forest because now you're away from the serious world of the court. And then you play a script. One of the most important love scripts in the West is the script of A Marriage Ceremony. When you show up to your own wedding, you need to be ready to tell the truth. In fact, there are philosophers who have spent decades thinking about what it means when the wedding ceremony comes to you and it's your time to say, I do. And then the officiant says, I now pronounce you man and wife. Well, what happens then? He could have said it differently. He could have said, you are married. It's less ceremonious. There's something about the person saying, I now, by speaking these words right now, as soon as I finish this sentence, you're married. And you're not married until I get to the end of the sentence. So that's called a performative speech act. It is a spoken formula that actually does something in the world. And there are performatives around us all over the place. But whenever you see the word do or now in a sentence spoken by a person, you're getting close to a performative. Performatives require that the person who is speaking is sincere. In fact, they require that everybody in the room is sincere. So You can't cross your fingers when you say, I do, in a wedding ceremony. The officiant can't do both fingers behind and say, I now pronounce. It's not that kind of situation. For it to work, first you have to have people say the right words in the right order. I do, I do. And then you need that topper from the officiant saying, I now pronounce you man and wife, you may kiss the bride. It's done. Probably the most powerful form of speech in our language. Performatives don't describe the world, they do things. And marriage is the most refined example of these words in action. So what Shakespeare does, because he's aware that words, just by saying them, have certain consequences, right? You lie. Oh, that's getting you down the path of a duel. I do. I take you. Spoken words are actions. The actions are recognized as being consequential by everyone in the community. If people don't believe it, and if the words aren't spoken correctly, it doesn't work. So why is it that Rosalind, as Ganymede, decides with Orlando to stage a wedding? I'm going to read you a little bit of dialogue from this scene. This is Rosalind as Ganymede talking to Orlando. Orlando says, love me, Rosalind. And she says, yes, faith, I will. Fridays, Saturdays, and all. And wilt thou have me? I and 20 such. What sayest thou? Are you not good? Orlando, I hope so. Why then, can one desire too much of a good thing? Come, sister, she's talking now to Celia. Will you be the priest and marry us? Give me your hand, Orlando. What do you say, sister? She's getting a little bit nervous. Orlando says, pray, marry us. And Celia says, I cannot say the words. This could be about to get very serious. And actually, that's true about all dialogue between Orlando and Rosalind, because they are on the verge of becoming very, very serious. But at this point, Orlando and Ganymede are playing it out as if it were a game, but it's a game about the most serious thing you can say to a lover. Celia, go to. Will you, Orlando, have wife this Rosalind? Orlando, I will. Ganymede, aye, but when? Why now, as fast as she can marry us. Rosalind, then you must say, she's coaching him. You must say, I take thee, Rosalind, for wife. And Orlando repeats it, I take thee, Rosalind, for wife. But if you think about what they're doing, they're using play and acting about something that's very serious to open up some doors and get a little bit of play and ease their way into it. I think it shows us actually that Orlando has no idea what it means to say, I take thee. He's playing. But what about her? I think she knows exactly what this is. And so when you watch her on stage tonight, you have to remember that she is thinking this through. I'm about to play this game with the man I want to be my husband. Let's pretend to get married. He thinks I'm a man. I'm a woman. So there is evidence that she is serious. And there's a turn in this back and forth, and it's really wonderful if it's played well, and I think it is in this production. But it's the moment when she realizes, not because of anything he said, but because of what she's saying, that actually this is quite serious. And being able to see that happen in someone as they're talking and realizing, oh, wait a minute, I'm not playing. I really care about this person. What am I going to do? And that moment for her comes when she realizes that men, and this is what is her obstacle, men are fickle. And here's her take on it. Rosalind. Orlando says, when will you put, she says, when will you possess your wife? Well, there's a good question. Forever and a day. Now, Rosalind, say a day without the ever. No, no, Orlando. Men are April when they woo, December when they wed. Maids are May when they are maids, but the sky changes when they are wives. I will be more jealous of thee than a Barbary cock pigeon over his hen, more clamorous than a parrot against rain, more newfangled than an ape, more giddy in my desires than a monkey. I will weep for nothing like Diana in the fountain, and I will do that when you are disposed to be merry. I will laugh like a hyena, and that when thou art inclined to sleep. So there's a little bit of seriousness in there. It's the same kind of seriousness that comes over Viola when Orsino talks to her. Have you ever been in love? Tell me what love is like. And Viola says, you know, men are actually like this, and women are actually like this, which she can say because she's disguised as a man. Same thing's happening here. She's recognizing the fact that it will be inevitable that his lightness, his merriness, that's the word she uses, but it means frivolousness. Everything we've seen about this man suggests that he doesn't reflect, that he's in love with ideas, and he really is not standing on the ground on his own feet. She knows that. And she's starting to give him a hint and then us a hint that it won't be easy. Here's an interesting one. I am going to become an animal like a parrot. Parrots are famous for imitating. Like a monkey. Monkeys are famous both for imitating and also for being lustful. She says, you're going to go become a very merry man. I, this boy who's pretending to be a girl, am eventually going to become an animal. People are changing in this situation, and she's just marking that. And I take this from that moment in the play. I think Shakespeare is looking for his audience to jump in and join the characters on this journey. He's gotten you into the theater. He's gotten you to say yes to something quite interesting. As soon as these boys come out and start playing girls, and as soon as you think they're the character, you've said yes to something that's obviously untrue. And that's the mark that you're in. You've decided to accept something that is clearly false as something you believe in. I'm willing to believe this for an hour and a half. Why? Because I want to go to the place that you're taking me. Just the theater is fueled by the desire of the people to see a play, to go away, to think differently, to imagine something that is not true. That's the most important part of it. Why do I like this play? Because it's not true. I believe it because I know it's false. Just think about what human beings are capable of. Just first, you got this really interesting courtship scene where a beloved is figuring out how to tutor her lover by replaying what she wants to have happen, which is a wedding, but commenting on it at the same time. She believes it. She doesn't believe it. She hopes for it. Maybe it's impossible. People are amazing. They're able to hold those very contradictory things as, you know, both true. And if you weren't able to do that, the theater would not work. It would just collapse. You have to have this very interesting ability that children actually have almost spontaneously to say, well, of course I know, you know, this is a chair, but it's also a cow. It's something I imagine it to be. You've got to be able to do that. And if Twelfth Night, or if As You Like It works, and it's the same with Twelfth Night, it works because you are invited to go along with something that you know is impossible, that you enjoy the fact that the play is talking about all of this, sending little signals to you. Remember, this is a boy playing a woman, playing a man, mimicking a woman. Shakespeare just expects you to be following all of that higher math all the way through. He expected that of the audience. And it's a way of apprehending reality that is really only possible when you're in the forest. You just have to go into those conditions and then retrieve this ability, which I think we often lose when we become professionals, when we grow up, when we've had enough experience. It becomes all the more meaningful when you find that that's the place you want to go. And that is a very adult kind of pleasure that we take in comedy. You know, maybe a child would think one thing about this play, but if it really means something when you get to those weddings at the end and you're really happy about it and you know that it's a big, gorgeous lie, you know something very complicated about yourself, which is that you want that. You want that to be true. You know full well that this is a Shakespeare play, that people are making it up. Doesn't matter. And that's the reality of our wishes. It's the magic of playing, and I think it's the deep magic of this play, which I hope you will enjoy tonight.